This is Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. This hour, world leaders consider a global recession. The last time world leaders converged to discuss monetary policy and the economic relationship between countries, they arrived at a bucolic retreat in the New Hampshire woods and departed with an agreement that still holds today, mostly. This time, there will be no wooded resort. They've gathered at the National Building Museum on the Washington Mall in D.C. And although presidents Lula da Silva from Brazil, Hu Jintao from China, Prime Minister Stephen Harper of Canada, Kevin Rudd of Australia, and even a chancellor, Angela Merkel from Germany, have all flown in, some observers question whether much will come out of it. We'll talk about that with our guests. We'll also talk about what some of these countries want from each other and what's within their power to do to stabilize the world's economy. And how much of a difference does it make that President-elect Barack Obama is not there? We're joined this morning by Mike Mandel. He's chief economist at Businessweek magazine, author of a new textbook titled Economics, the Basics. And Mike, it occurs to me that we could all use an economics textbook right about now. Good to have you on the show.
It's true, isn't it? Glad to be here.
Matthew Bishop is with us as well. He's a chief business writer and U.S. business editor of The Economist magazine. And he's with us this morning from London. Matthew Bishop, thanks for making some time for us today.
Good to be here.
Later in the hour, Brad Setzer is going to join us. He's a fellow of geoeconomics at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he'll be with us from New York. Matthew, your prime minister was apparently at a fancy dinner on Monday night with financiers in London, and he told them this about the summit. I want this to become the moment when we rise to the new challenges by purposeful, visionary, and international leadership, leaving behind the orthodoxies of yesterday. Can this meeting really deliver on all of that?
Well, it can't, but I think it's going to be a starting point. One reason it can't is because the new president is not going to be there, probably quite wisely staying away until he gets a better look at what the economy's like when he inherits it. But it certainly can be a start. There are two challenges. One challenge is to bring about coordinated policy around the world to stop the economy going into a deep recession and to get it back into a growth phase as quickly as possible. That's largely about interest rate policy and government spending, fiscal policy. And then secondly, the challenge is to create an international architecture to oversee the financial and economic system, which is going to make sure that we don't have the kind of catastrophic outcomes that we've seen in the past year or so. That, I think, is longer term project. You can't do that this weekend, and it would be actually probably the worst time to actually try and come up with those long-term solutions during the middle of the crisis. The thing we have to do at the moment is to stop the crisis getting any worse and put ourselves on the road to recovery.
So, Mike Mandel, do you agree that this is really to lay a foundation among these countries, specifically then how much actually gets completed here?
I don't think much is going to get completed here, and I'm not even sure that this is the right time to lay a foundation.
Why?
If you think about it, the main thing that needs to be done is just an agreement and not stab each other in the back. And because we have a situation here where a country is going to have to choose between doing stuff which is globally positive versus kind of looking to their own self-interest, and the main thing is that people have to be able to act together. The problem is if you sort of have this meeting, okay, without Barack Obama, and before the foundation has really been laid, there's a question about whether people walk away more agitated than they came in.
Mm-hmm. Why would that happen, though?
Well, think about it. These are countries that have very different interests. I mean, Matthew said, you know, they're going to run monetary policy and fiscal policy, but it matters what kind they run. It matters whether or not, for example, China runs a stimulus which is focused on boosting its own consumption, which would be good, or is it going to try to keep boosting exports, which would make the global financial problem worse? Are you going to have a situation where countries try to devalue their currencies in order to boost their own economies? And so this is a period where acting together is very important. But you know, without the U.S., it's very hard to come to a conclusion.
Matthew Bishop, well, we've already seen some examples of countries kind of circling the wagons. We saw this when there were bank failings in different parts of Europe, and countries were saying, well, look, we'll back our own banks here. We don't want money moving from our country's banks to other countries' banks. Do they have to let go of some of that to really make this work?
Well, I think it's a balancing act because on the one hand, banking and finance is basically still regulated by nations. They do have their own banks. They ultimately, when their banks get into trouble, are going to be the ones who have to find the money to keep them alive or to deal with the mess if they don't keep them alive. So it's a national problem. On the other hand, those banks are all operating in a global economy. And so what happens elsewhere has important consequences for your own bank. And so what is clear is that the cross-border risks and the games that people were playing between different regulatory systems in different countries made this financial crisis worse than it would have been otherwise. And so there is a need for all these nations to actually coordinate their regulatory activities and to get their policies all pulling together rather than competing with each other. But as Mike says, this is actually extremely difficult, and there's already going to be countries that are thinking, you know, this is a great opportunity for us to have a different set of regulations, a different set of policies that when the economy recovers, a lot of capital will flow to us rather than, say, to the United States.
Mike, if these countries were really serious, and again, I know you've both pointed out, without Barack Obama, there's only so much that will be done here. But if the countries were really serious, tell me what would be on the table? What kinds of things would be talked about this weekend?
Let me just back up 1 second. The scariest moment for me in this crisis so far was when the UK sued Iceland for the money that was in the Icelandic banks, because that's exactly the sort of thing that you don't want. Countries have to say, look, we're not going to attack other countries, either legally or economically, for our money. We're going to, in fact, and even now, the bailout of Iceland is being blocked. And so you want a situation where countries say, yes, I understand that this bank problem is over here and not in here, but let me actually spread my wings and encompass everybody under it. I and a lot of other people have sort of written about this before. Ideally, you would have had a global central bank to sort of oversee a global economy and a global financial system. We don't have a global central bank. We're not going to have a global central bank that comes out of this meeting.
So why not, though?
Well, because it requires countries to give up sovereignty, which they are going to be adverse to do unless the crisis gets worse, which we don't want it to get worse. But you know, the fact is, we know how to run an economy and a financial system, and it's not the way we've been running it. You can't run it with a lot of national regulators. So in some sense, this conference is being tasked to do something which just can't get done.
Matthew, I want to read a couple of lines from that were written in an article in The Economist magazine this week. It says, because everyone agrees that something big needs fixing and that the world expects action, calling the summit Bretton Woods II could yet come to be seen as a rallying cry for reform, and yet there are lots of reasons to see it as vainglory. Maybe just a quick recap of Bretton Woods I. New Hampshire,
well,
1944, right?
Yeah, I mean, Bretton Woods I was this extraordinary moment, which is associated with the great economist John Maynard Keynes, when really the system that has governed the world economy for the last 64 years, including things like the World Bank IMF arrangements and the different sorts of interventions that could be done, were decided by this extraordinary conference. And I think people are saying now, let's create a new set of institutions or architecture that is going to work for the next 64 years.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble is that we already have a number of institutions in place, that the world has actually realized that creating institutions doesn't necessarily solve problems, it just creates a whole load of new problems quite a lot of the time. The idea that you could ever have a global central bank is, you know, it's just beyond political practicality and imagination. It's just and wouldn't necessarily work. So I find it it's just so far off the agenda. It's not true. So You know, I think this is a thing where politicians want to be seen to be decisive this weekend. I'm sure there is going to be a great uplifting statement that everyone will sign up to.
Right.
But I was actually talking to the Canadian finance minister earlier this week, and he said, well, look, what we really want to do is be modest in our ambitions. You know, what we really want is to learn about the virtues of being boring in finance, and it's being boring and doing the prudential things that actually avoid crises rather than creating new structures, which I guess is what got finance into difficulty in the first place.
Well, would you agree, would both of you agree, it is a time for modesty here, or is it a time for some bold ideas of reform?
Well, I think it's a time when clearly the economy of the world is teetering on the brink of a really severe downturn, and therefore we need to resurrect the spirit of Keynes and actually start pumping some money into the economy, as is already happening, but really to make sure that demand is up and strong and that we get growing again. It isn't the time to come up with new institutions that we don't really know what they're there for and we don't quite know how they will work, because I think there's a pressure to look like you're doing things. That's the wrong basis on which to create a new institution.
Mike, I'm surprised to hear Matthew Bishop say it's a time for pumping money into the economy. I thought we were doing that in massive amounts.
Isn't it interesting that Matthew's talking about pumping money in without new institutions? I mean, I'm not sure why you need a big conference to do that. I think what we've seen here is that the global economy was out of whack, okay, in terms of the U.S. being this mammoth borrower and China being this mammoth producer with that much consumption,
mm-hmm.
and Europe not being sure which one it wants to be. And so that's not a sustainable position, and to my mind, that's kind of the underlying reality, and that's the reason why all these countries come to this conference with really very different interests. So what you're looking at is you're not looking at this kind of theoretical thing. You're looking at that the interests of China, the interests of the U.S., and the interests of Europe are very different at this point. And the question is, can we resolve that? Does it require a new set of institutions, or does it just require a sense of shared welfare?
Let me invite some listeners into the conversation. We'll come back to this idea of pumping money into the global economy. Matthew Bishop is one of our guests, Mike Mandel the other, this morning, as we take a closer look at the agendas that these countries and their leaders have gathered in Washington for this international global summit, talking about the economy welcomed by President Bush, taking a look at what's happening recession-wise, this potential recession around the globe, but also taking a look at some monetary policy. But as we're hearing from our guests this morning, they all come with special interests and special agendas. So we're asking what really comes out of a meeting like this. How important is it that Barack Obama himself is not there? He has sent people to act in his stead and to listen in to the conversation. Matthew Bishop, chief business writer and U.S. business editor of The Economist magazine, and joining us this morning from London. And Mike Mandel, chief economist at Businessweek magazine, author of a new textbook titled Economics, The Basics. A little later in the hour, Brad Setzer is going to be with us. He's a fellow of geoeconomics at the Council on Foreign Relations. If you'd like to join the conversation, you have questions about details of the conversation, perhaps some of the policy, if any serious policy ends up coming out of this, you can join us, 800-242-2828. If you're listening in the metro area, 651-227-6000. If you're online this morning, minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question, 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, online, minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question. So, Matthew, to come back to this this idea of pumping more money into the global economy, as I noted to Mike Mandel, it seems like the U.S. especially and other countries have been doing that. What's missing?
Well, they have been doing a lot of money has been committed by governments around the world. A lot of it has gone into the banking system, but not come out of the banking system. It's gone in to sort of rebuild the capital base of the banking system. It's gone to, in some extent, buy bad assets to try and free up the bank lending system. But it's not broadly gone out into the economy as a whole. And so that's where you need continuing reduction in interest rates, and we're obviously down quite a long way in the US, but less so in some other parts of the world like Western Europe, which has gone into recession now.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you need fiscal policy. Now, again, in normal times, the last thing I would be advising would be that the US government increase its deficit, which is already wildly out of control.
Yes.
But at this moment, given we're on the precipice, given that we've seen what happened in the past, like the 1930s where we went into a depression, this is a time where the government has to start spending some money on things like infrastructure rebuilding, which is actually necessary in America anyway, and there are lots of projects ready to go. And there's a big opportunity here to actually create demand, to create employment at a time when other companies and other parts of the economy are battening down the hatches, being very prudent, cutting back, firing lots of people. And the danger is, we are at this point where things could go much, much worse than what we've seen in the last year.
To the phones to Nicholas in Hudson, Wisconsin. Hi, Nicholas. Your question.
My question is, a pattern that we use often in life is to make mistakes, because mistakes happen, but learn from them. Learn from those mistakes and move on. So in this situation of the global economy crisis and stuff, why can't we just determine what mistakes were made, learn from them, and then move on, versus coming up with a whole new shebang that's going to have its own new mistakes?
Mike, Economics 101 in that textbook, why can't we?
That's an excellent question, and the reason why is it depends on who you ask. They identify different mistakes at this point. Some people will blame this on the financial system. They say, look, this is the result of out-of-control Wall Street firms lending out money, over-leveraging derivatives, what have you, all right? And in that case, the right thing to do is increased financial regulation. I look at it from a different position. I sort of say that the financial crisis is a symptom, not a cause, and that the underlying cause is the imbalances in the global economy, where the U.S. has just been consuming far more than has been sustainable, and in the process, built up all this debt. And so, we have to diagnose the problem first before you identify the cure. Now, I just want to make one point. In the Great Depression, the problem was that they had a wrong diagnosis for many years, and they did the wrong thing, and it got them into big trouble. So in this situation, having the correct diagnosis, identifying the mistakes, is not easy.
Matthew, do you agree with Mike Mandel's assessment of this, that the global economy was out of whack, the U.S. building up too much debt, and that's part of the reason of why we're where we are today?
Well, I do, and we've at The Economist been arguing that there have been really severe imbalances for at least a decade, and certainly in the last 5 years we've been sounding the alarm louder and louder. But this particular crisis has come to a head, I think, because of essentially bad risk management within the financial sector. And then secondly, and catastrophically, Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary's decision to allow Lehman Brothers to go bankrupt, which I think completely freaked out everyone else that's lending to other banks and anyone that's lending at all in the financial system, and has caused a massive flight out of debt, out of borrowing, out of lending, that is going to cause maybe 5,000 hedge funds to go bust, which means a lot of them are being forced to sell assets, which is pushing down the share prices and bond prices even further than they would have gone anyway, and is just creating this general sense of things getting worse and becoming much more volatile and risky. And until now we get through this process, which is going to take several more months before there's any sign that the unwinding of all these debt-based trading strategies is completed, until that's over, things are going to feel much worse, and it's going to be hard to see any sign of progress. And that's why I think Obama is actually quite wise to stay out of the situation until January, when things will hopefully be looking a bit clearer.
An online comment about that from Mike in Rochester says, Kerry, I believe the president-elect is handling it perfectly. He should focus on the transition. He can do more than one thing at a time. To the phones, to Bill in Deep Haven. Hi, Bill.
Yes, we'll listen to all the sort of large-scale economic theoretical discussions, and that's interesting. But I think it's more fundamental than that. I think that the consumer, which drives a major part of the U.S. economy, has just overspent and way overextended themselves for years and years. And I think what's happened on Wall Street has been kind of a wake-up call to them for whatever reasons it's happened. But I think people are going to be reassessing their own debt structures, and we're going to see a lot less consumer spending for some time until they get that more aligned with something that's more reasonable. And I just like to hear the commentator's thoughts on that. I'll take it offline.
And, Mike, let me add to this real quick. Crossing the wire here out of Washington, retail sales plunging by the largest amount on record in October as the financial crisis and the slumping economy caused consumers to sharply cut back on their spending, doing some of what our caller is suggesting. What kind of an impact is that going to have?
Well, I agree 100% with the caller, okay, that this is that consumer spending has been out of whack. If you look over the last 10 years, people have been boosting their spending far faster than the economy has been growing and piling up debt in the process. And this is what I mean by sort of finding the right diagnosis. It may very well be that this drop in consumer spending is, in fact, absolutely essential right now, that we as an economy overinvested in retailing in certain types of purchases, including autos, and we underinvested in things like R&D and infrastructure and so forth. And so this may be this might be an opportunity, but it was pretty clear to me, at least, that this was not sustainable and that, yes, there were certain things that triggered it, but there is a fundamental problem that's been going on for a long time.
Matthew, you mentioned the concern in Europe among other observers of Secretary Paulson's decision to let Lehman Brothers fail. Overall, what's Europe's view of the way Secretary Paulson has handled this? And I'm sure you saw the news yesterday of his testimony saying what his changed plans for that $700 billion bailout money that he's got.
Well, I don't think it's just Europe. I think there's a lot of people, in America that feel very disturbed by the way Paulson has handled the whole affair. I mean, he seems not to have particularly had a big picture view of what's been going on. He's kind of stumbled from one little crisis to the next and fixing each one as he's gone along without any sense of a sort of broad guiding rationale for what he's been doing. And you know, I think the Europeans, Gordon Brown, as you mentioned earlier, were quicker to realize that you needed to take equity positions to actually buy shares in some of the banks to stop them collapsing. And he's copied that and abandoned some of the strategy he had to buy assets, which, wasn't particularly working. So he's been a bit slower than Europe. But I think Europe has hardly been a role model for anyone in its handling of the crisis either. I mean, the whole thing has been badly managed by everybody, I think.
Mike Mandel, your assessment of how Paulson has managed this so far?
Well, I don't think he's managed it very well, but I mean, I give him a buy in one sense, which is that it's difficult to diagnose this problem. Everybody was saying originally that it was based in the housing sector, and you have to sort of say it wasn't obvious to begin with that in fact it was going to turn into the global crisis that people have been expecting for a long time. It's only now that we kind of wrap our minds around it that we see what a big deal this is. Now, the fact that he asked for $700 billion, which seemed like an enormous amount of money right up front and has been spending it, is actually a really good thing. It's just a down payment, but he's going to get high marks for speed but then also low marks for confusion.
Well, Mike, does he get high marks for flexibility? I mean, you hear him coming to Capitol Hill and saying, I'm never going to apologize for, essentially changing my mind, going with what's happening on the economic landscape and making changes as a result of that.
No, he doesn't need to apologize for that. But the fact is, he should apologize for sounding panicked, which he has at various points. And And he should apologize for being so dogmatic on the original plan when it was pretty clear to lots of economists that the plan of buying up these mortgage-backed securities was not the right plan. And so he's kind of zigged and zagged and really contributed to the air of panic. Now, what I do have to say is that what this suggests is that whoever Barack Obama appoints as Treasury Secretary should take this time, take a deep breath, get really centered, and come out and be very calm and keep going and have a strategy and stick with it, because that's what people want to see at this point.
Matthew, who should be the Secretary of the Treasury in the Obama administration?
Well, I mean, obviously, this is a big choice that Obama's got to make. It's probably the most important choice that he's going to make in his first cabinet. Two names keep coming up. One is Tim Geithner, who's currently head of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, mm-hmm. and the other is Larry Summers, who's mm-hmm. done the job before. Personally, I think Geithner's done a very good job. He's been a much more, I think, reliable figure than Paulson. I also think Larry Summers, though formidably bright and did a reasonable job as Treasury Secretary before, does have a habit of saying things that are provocative and alarming to many people, and that he would not be the sort of reassuring figure that I would want to see in any of the moments of crisis that we've been through in the past year. I could imagine him making everyone else feel they were idiots and or that he thought they were idiots, which is not really a good basis for solving any of these complex problems. So I hope he goes with Geithner.
All right. Matthew, good to talk with you. I hope you'll join us again sometime. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Matthew Bishop is chief business writer and U.S. business editor of The Economist magazine. He's with us from London. Mike Mandel continues with us, chief economist at Businessweek magazine. And we're going to be joined here after news by Brad Setzer. He's a fellow of geoeconomics at the Council on Foreign Relations as we talk about this economic summit that is going on in Washington. If you have questions about that, 800-242-2828, 651-221-2276000. You can also join us online at MinnesotaPublicRadio.org and click on Send a Question. At the top of the hour, a special letters segment. What you've been writing to tell me about mid-morning. That's close to 10 o'clock. But to the newsroom and Perry Finelli. Good morning, Perry.
Good morning, Carrie. Investigators told the National Transportation Safety Board today a design error made more than four decades ago set the stage for last year's deadly 35W bridge collapse. At a hearing in Washington today, NTSB investigators said steel gusset plates holding the bridge's center span failed because their design by the engineering firm of Sperdrup and Parcell in 1963 was inadequate. They say the error was a failure of omission because not all the necessary calculations were performed and the half-inch thick plates were not strong enough. Sverdrup and Parcell was acquired in 1999 by Jacobs Engineering Group of Pasadena, California. The five-member NTSB board plans to vote today on the probable cause of the bridge collapse, which killed 13 people and injured 145. It will also vote on a series of safety recommendations. Retail sales plunged by the largest amount on record in October. Sales fell by 2.8%. It's the fourth consecutive monthly decline. Wall Street is responding by giving back some of yesterday's big gains. Barack Obama and John McCain meet on Monday, and Obama spokeswoman says the two will talk about ways of bringing Americans a more effective and efficient government. The meeting will take place at Obama's Chicago transition office. Vietnam era radical Bill Ayers says he knows Barack Obama no better than thousands of other people in Chicago. In an interview this morning on ABC's Good Morning America, Ayers says the two didn't even meet before Ayers hosted an event at his home for Obama. A rapidly spreading wildfire near Santa Barbara, California, has charred nearly 4 square miles. Officials say at least 100 homes and a college dormitory in the foothills of Montecito have been destroyed. About 5,400 homes in the community have been evacuated. 13 people have been injured. For Minnesota, cloudy skies today, scattered rain and snow showers, highs low 30s north, low 40s south, Twin Cities now cloudy and 35. It's 9:35. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
Support for this program comes from the Minnesota 529 College Savings Plan, a tax-advantaged way to save for future college education expenses at any qualified college in the nation. More at mnsaves.org.
Programming is supported by the Galleria, presenting their holiday open house November 14th through 16th. Saturday, NPR's classical host Julie Amacher and the Crocus Hill Trio will be live at the Galleria 1 to 3. Schedule of events at GalleriaEdina.com.
We're back on Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. I have some breaking news about books here for you. If you haven't checked out the Mid-Morning book page, I hope you will. Lots of information about books that I'm reading and authors that will be coming up on the show. There's information there about how you can join the Carrie Miller Book Club. Lots of details there about how to do that. I'm getting emails from listeners saying, so how do I get in on this? You can find out on the book page. And I have been remiss in not announcing our next Mid-Morning Book Club book. We're going to talk about it in late January, the last Friday of January. I think it's January 30th. And I have been receiving recommendations. I have a huge file here from listeners. As you know, we talk about classics, or we talk about novels that you'd love to go back to, that maybe you read in high school English or something. I mean, everything we've read, Pride and Prejudice, The Things They Carried, A Confederacy of Dunces. I've asked a lot of writers who have been in the studio here for their suggestions. And I want to let you know we have chosen Joseph Campbell's Heart of Darkness. The reason I chose it is because I was hearing from a lot of listeners who wanted to read it. And then our managing editor for online news, Mike Resler, who is a voracious reader, made a very compelling case for it. So that's the book, Joseph Campbell's Heart of Darkness. Read it over the Christmas holidays, maybe. And we'll talk about it with you, I hope, on January 30th. More about that will be posted on the Mid-Morning book page. All right, back to our conversation this hour. And Brad Setzer is joining us now. He's a fellow of geoeconomics at the Council on Foreign Relations and with us this morning from New York. Brad, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We've had some alternative opinions this morning on just what we expect or don't expect from this economic summit. So I'll just start by asking you, is there anything that you'll be watching for closely as these world leaders meet?
I think I'll be watching for three things. I think I will be watching first to see what precisely they say about the need for some kind of fiscal stimulus on a global level, just how strong that portion of the statement that emerges is.
Okay.
I think they've already telegraphed that there will be a component of their statement that will have some rhetoric around that, but the wording may give some signals about how much, whether any country is now willing to do more than people thought going in.
Okay.
Second thing, what, if anything, they say about the International Monetary Fund, the role they expect the International Monetary Fund to play going forward, and the amount of money that they're willing to provide the IMF to allow it to provide potentially more credit to cash-strapped emerging economies.
So this would be these countries putting a dollar amount on what they're willing to contribute to the IMF?
Well, I think there are two issues. One is whether they want to signal, and I think the answer to this is unfortunately no, that there's a need for a bigger IMF in the future. And then the second is whether other countries will follow Japan's lead and indicate that they will loan some of their reserves to the IMF,
okay,
which is something you could do pretty quickly.
And the third thing?
What they will say about the agenda going forward, what the work plan for this will probably be kicked to the finance ministers who already have met in the past at the G20 level and central bank governors, and they'll be given some assignments, and they'll be asked probably to come back to the leaders with some proposals, and I will be curious what precisely they're asked to do.
And Mike Mandel, how much will you be trying to parse this statement about future meetings? How confident are you that there will be future meetings at this level?
I'm not going to put all that much attention into parsing this particular statement. This meeting is off schedule because of the U.S. elections, and whatever they come up with this time is going to be fairly bland, okay, because they're going to want to know which direction Obama's going to go.
To the phones, 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 to Dale in Worthington. Hi, Dale. Thanks for waiting. Your question.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm good.
This is a little old country boy from out here in the southwestern part of Minnesota.
Okay.
And I think logic tells me that outsourcing is coming home to roost. You can't ship $30 a year jobs overseas and replace them with $10 a year jobs here in the United States and expect the consumer to have any money to buy in the first place without borrowing. And I think that maybe is something we have to look at.
Brad Setzer, outsourcing.
Well, I would actually put it in a much broader context. It's not just outsourcing. It's a global economy where, for the past several years, the U.S. has paid for its rising imports from the emerging world, whether it's more oil from Saudi Arabia or more goods from China, by selling those countries' treasury bills or Freddie and Fannie bonds rather than by selling goods. And I think over time, there does need to be a re-equilibration where the U.S. pays for much more of its imports with selling goods and services. And if that were to happen, I think there probably would be more, you know, of the so-called good jobs for Americans. So I think part of it isn't just outsourcing. It's a global economy where, for a host of reasons, the U.S. exports until very recently didn't grow at the same pace as U.S. imports from the emerging world. And I think the fact that countries like China have intervened in the currency market to hold their currency down has played a big role in that.
And Mike, I want to ask you about China. Recently announcing that they would launch, a nearly $600 billion stimulus package where they would build infrastructure, be focused primarily on rebuilding some infrastructure. How much of a difference is that going to make?
It depends what China actually does. If they do things which boost consumer spending, if they put a lot of new money into it, then it could make a difference. If what they're doing is they're repositioning money they were already planning to spend and keep supporting exports, then they still haven't quite anteed up to the table yet. But I want to actually add something to what Brad said.
Sure.
You know, actually, Brad and I have been in discussions over the years about this very question. And I, you know, I put more, up to about a year ago, I put more of an optimistic face on the structure of the global economy than he did. But I've come around to Brad's point of view sort of basically since the middle of 2007, which is that the U.S. borrowing this much and outsourcing in this way was unsustainable. The real question is which road we take from now. Do we try to get jobs back from overseas by subsidies, by various protectionist measures, or do we do a lot of investment in cutting-edge industries, high-tech stuff that other countries can't match, and so we create new jobs that way?
And which direction do you think we should go?
Oh, I think we should definitely go the second one. Okay, which requires a lot of it. I mean, one place where that sort of makes a difference is in things like autos, which is: do you try to protect your existing jobs, or do you think that what you want to do is you want to find new growth industries and with a lot of federal support? But in either case, we have to get out of this situation where we are borrowing so much from overseas to support our consumption, because that's just not sustainable.
Brad, it is true, though, isn't it, that there will be more borrowing in the short term as we go through this recession and the Obama administration tries to amp up the economy. Isn't that right?
That's certainly right. But I think, you know, we have to be precise by what we mean by more borrowing. There will certainly be the federal government will be borrowing a lot more. And it should, in part to do some of the investments that Mike has mentioned, but also just to offset what now looks to be a rather severe and very sudden slowdown in U.S. economic activity. But I think we'll actually be borrowing a bit less from the rest of the world. For one reason, we're not going to be paying quite as much for imported oil, which will make the biggest contribution. Mm-hmm. But also, we're going to be slowing. We're not going to be importing as much. So we're going to be borrowing more at the federal government level. But as opposed to borrowing from the rest of the world, the federal government's going to be borrowing a little bit more from Americans, because it's likely that Americans, particularly if you judge from some of the consumer spending data, are going to be saving a little bit more.
To the phones, to Randy in St. Cloud. Hi, Randy. Your question.
Well, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I notice when I hear these discussions about what went wrong, the spin is starting to be pretty consistent that it's us. We spend too much. And isn't the real, freeze-up right now in the market from the financial institutions themselves with the credit default swaps? You guys did a program on, This American Life, where they kind of explained what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And we've allowed the financial institutions basically to jump into insurance and not regulate it, and there's no money backing these credit default swaps, and that's why nobody wants to borrow any money.
Right.
And if we just kind of would regulate that and make it be what it is, insurance, and not let people do it anymore, wouldn't that help open things up again?
Brad, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's always the case that if for every borrower, there's also a lender. And if Wall Street hadn't been as willing to lend, Americans wouldn't have been as able to borrow. And the credit default swaps were part of the process that facilitated borrowing, not directly in most cases, because credit default swaps are insurance against the risk that a bond will fall into default. And so they don't necessarily provide the direct extension of credit. But because such insurance was available, other people were more willing to lend, so I think they indirectly contributed to the lending. But then going back to the point that the caller made, I do think it is the case that the credit default swap market, because some people were writing insurance without the capacity to make good on that insurance, without having collateral or other assets that realistically could back it, particularly in bad states of the world, and AIG is the most obvious example. I do think that was a problem, and that it is something that we need to address going forward. And there are ideas such as putting credit default swaps on organized exchanges where people have to put up collateral that would help to limit some of the risk-taking that was facilitated by these kinds of innovations.
Mike, one of the things that I've been curious about just in the dynamics of this meeting is whether any of these countries' leaders will be somewhat open about the anger that some of them clearly feel about how the U.S. financial system was managed and what it has now triggered and the consequences that other countries around the world are feeling because of that. Will anybody talk about that, do you think?
I think if this conference had been held 6 months ago, you would have heard a lot of that.
Really?
But now it's becoming clear to most people that the problems were systemic across the global financial system. I mean, nobody, the failure of the Icelandic banks, nobody can blame that on the U.S. financial system. And in the same way, there was an awful lot of European banks which seem to have taken very big risks, not just investing in the U.S., but in Eastern Europe. And I think it's gradually dawning on people that this is not purely a financial problem, but it's an economic problem, too.
Okay.
And that makes a big difference.
To David in Minneapolis. Hi, David.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to call and agree with the speaker who was talking about we need more R&D, research and development, and creating new industries. And I think a little more money for NASA and not killing the shuttle will help a long ways towards creating new jobs here in the U.S., as well as dealing with the energy issue, because nobody deals with solar power better than the space program.
Brad, curious about your thoughts on what you hear from Barack Obama when he talks about his energy policy being a jobs policy. And we've talked this morning about this idea of reinvesting in information technology, that may be the path that this country should be on instead of job protection for jobs that are potentially headed overseas. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I have a couple of different thoughts. I mean, I think we have to I think the overarching assumption that jobs, particularly jobs in manufacturing, are necessarily heading overseas needs to be rethought, because that was an assumption that was an accurate description in a world where the U.S. trade deficit was tending to get bigger year after year.
Mm-hmm.
I think we may be, and I would hope we're in for a period when the U.S. trade deficit tends to shrink. Which won't necessarily mean that all the old jobs will be coming back, but it may mean that some manufacturing jobs will be created. I wouldn't rule out that possibility, and I wouldn't rule out the possibility that we might be exporting wind turbines to China or our solar panels to India. So I think that the assumptions about how the economy was evolving in a world where credit was easily available, both inside the U.S. and for the U.S. from the rest of the world, and where the trade deficit tended to go up, may not always hold in a world where, you know, to use a bad economics term, where we're adjusting and where the trade deficit is falling over time. And so I think that if we're lucky as we come out of this crisis, there will be a change in the way the U.S. economy works, and some sectors that until now haven't been doing well may start doing well, and other sectors that until a year ago, like finance, that were doing very well may do less well.
Mike, you agree with that?
I believe that there's going to be a change, but I don't think it's going to happen automatically. I think that as part of the fiscal stimulus, as part of the recovery program, choices will have to be made about where we put the money, because there's going to be a lot. It's not even so much protecting jobs. The question is, are we going to protect consumption? Are we going to put lots of subsidies into areas like housing and autos, which we have over-consumed on over the last 10 years, or are we going to put them into other areas where we haven't put the money into and which need and which have the possibility for creating technologically advanced jobs? It's a political choice, and it's an economic choice.
I asked Matthew Bishop who he thinks the Obama transition team should be considering as Secretary of the Treasury, and I want to ask you both, and Brad, I'll ask you first. We've heard the names, Summers, Geithner, some of the others that are on the list. Is there anybody that, in your mind, moves to the top of that list, and maybe a name that we have not heard yet?
Well, I'm going to plead the fifth on this because I worked in the past for both Tim Geithner and for Larry Summers, and asking to choose between two people who you've worked for in the past is a good way to make sure you don't get to work for either in the future.
I see. Well, do you think it is right that those two names are near the top of the list? How about that?
I think that they are two of the most talented public servants that I've ever met.
Is this one of, and Brad, is this one of the key decisions that President-elect Obama makes going forward?
Yes, but I don't think it's just a choice about personnel, although people matter. It's also, in some sense, it's already been chosen because the American people elected President-elect Obama. But it's a choice about what kinds of policies that you want to pursue. And the core choice is you ultimately want a Treasury Secretary who's on board with the president's agenda. I also happen to have been in the Treasury Department during the last transition, and I was sort of a junior economist, not at a very senior level. And it was noticeable when Paul O'Neill came in, he wasn't fully on board with the President-elect Bush's agenda, President Bush's agenda, and he was coming in looking to change the agenda. And that can quickly erode the power of the Treasury Secretary because the White House loses trust in the Treasury. And so I think it works both ways. It has to be a choice of the right person, but also there has to be a high level of comfort between the Treasury Secretary and the President about what direction they want to go in.
Mike, how about you? Who should be at the top of the list?
Well, the problem that I have with Geithner is that, A, he's a very finance-oriented guy. That's where his experience is. And the other is he was involved in the Lehman decision, okay, which everybody kind of agrees was problematic. I think that we need somebody who has a very broad perspective on the situation here. This is not a process of fixing the financial system. This is a process of restructuring the U.S. and the global economy. And for that matter, for that reason, I'm looking for somebody with a broader perspective, whether it's Larry Summers or somebody else. I think it should be as broad brush a person and as with as much gravitas as possible.
Let's talk again when we find out who it is, all right?
Very good.
Mike, thank you so much. Brad Setzer, thank you very much. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And Mike Mandel, chief economist at Business Week magazine, and Brad Setzer, fellow at Geoeconomics at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Send a letter to me. Don't forget to to write each day.
Now to your letters. I'm still hearing from listeners who want to do a bit of bragging about how they scored on our civics quiz. If you caught the show, we talked about civic literacy on the day before the election and posted a test on our website. Well, a number of you took the test, and just as I've always suspected, we have a lot of bright people out there in the audience. Kevin Casterly wrote to say that he scored an 88% on the test, which is really good, better than a lot of the college students that took it. Christian McGuire wrote in to say that as a musicologist, he is, quote, constantly surprised at the lack of knowledge his students possess in basic American and even world history. And Julie Viken of Duluth wrote in to say that her mother had passed an interest in civics on to her, so she was a little dismayed to score a 68%. And Julie, I say to you, take heart. Many of the college students who took the test didn't even score above 50% on it. I also heard from St. Kate's University after our show on new research about political ideology on college campuses. At the beginning of the show, I mentioned that St. Kate's had canceled appearances by Hillary Clinton, Al Franken, and Babe Buchanan ahead of the election because they were concerned about having political balance on their list of invited speakers. And I quoted a student from a Star Trib story who said she thought it was insulting that students were not being given the opportunity to make their own decisions after listening to all sides. Well, we heard from Julie Michener, the media relations manager for the college, and she wrote to say that the College of St. Catherine's policy of nonpartisanship this election season was based on fairness, not on any perception that our students could not make political judgments for themselves. And finally, a shout out to anyone and everyone who is listening to Mid-Morning overseas. Deka Abdurrahman wrote to say that although he's attending college in Cairo, Egypt, he streams Mid-Morning on his laptop. Deka, great to know you're listening. I'd like to hear from all of you who are tuned in to Mid-Morning. You can write with your critiques, your kudos, any other comments that you'd like to make, and I'd like to hear them. To do that, send it to mail@npr.org. Again, kudos, critiques, comments all come to us at mail@npr.org. Coming up at 10 o'clock, Ruth Hayden is in the studio. It's been a couple months since we've talked with Ruth, and we've got some interesting ideas here. Ruth is here to talk about some recession strategies for your family, your budget, your pocketbook to put into place now that will better protect you the next time there's a downturn in the economy. So these are things that you may want to do now, maybe protect you a bit as we come into this recession, but also things that you may want to make a permanent part of your budget to protect you no matter what the economy does. That's most of the hour, but we begin the 10 o'clock hour with a conversation with Al Franken. If you've heard the news, you know that the Franken campaign filed a lawsuit in Ramsey County District Court yesterday. They want access to information about rejected absentee ballots. We'll talk with Al Franken about that. As you know, the recount is set to begin next week. In fact, we have a program scheduled for Tuesday morning about the nuts and bolts of the recount. So we'll talk with Al Franken about what he's expecting about that, and I hope you'll look forward and listen in next Tuesday to our conversation about the recount. And one correction that I want to make. When I announced our mid-morning book choice, I think I said Joseph Campbell. I meant to say Joseph Conrad as Heart of Darkness. That's our choice. We'll talk about it at the end of January. My apologies for that. I hope you'll read the book. This is Mid-Morning.
Programming is supported by Pentair, a Minnesota-based diversified company with 15,000 employees. Pentair's products are designed to help create safe, clean water worldwide and protect electronic and electric equipment and the people using it. Pentair.com.